Clashing number 12922, Squadron Leader Ronald Meredith, Reel 2.
I think we were talking there about the Francis Pym and his address to the worthy burghers and populace of Newbury. As I was saying, the bottom line, he was postulating that we had to have something to trade. And if we didn't have the cruise missile, we would have nothing to trade. There would be nothing to counterbalance these surface-to-surface tactical and medium-range missiles held in the Warsaw Pact. And he actually said that if NATO have done its sums correctly, if the intelligence assessment are correct, and if the guys working on this mutual balanced force reduction team have got their ideas right, then the missiles could not be here forever and a day. They were being introduced as a bargaining counter. As a loyal member of NATO, the UK had agreed to position them in the UK. As a result of a vast number of studies, Newbury had been selected, or Greenham Common specifically had been selected as one of the storage bases for them, and that this, as he said, would not be a long-term commitment. I have a feeling that he may even have said, I would give it 6 to 10 years, and I think he was about right. Certainly his initial prognosis was correct. But that was the tenor for the meeting. The very first question that was actually asked to him was also relevant, and I must admit it was not planted. I hasten to say we had no hand in this. All the questions were written, they were then put into a drum, and they were pulled out by, I think it was the chairman or the secretary of the district council, who was acting as the chairman for the meeting. And I said, Mr. Bloggs, you know, your question, please. And the first question came out, and it was, would the minister please be kind enough to give us an assurance regarding the future of our air show? Now, what I haven't mentioned is that Greenham Common had been used for an air show. There was an organisation known as the International Air Tattoo. It's a British organisation, rather like a mirror of Farm, but they run a rather splendid air show. And Greenham had already had one air show. And the locals had been so enamoured by this that this large flying station had been, for a weekend, turned into the most marvellous flying display and everything related to aviation that, you know, they regard it as, and I said, a guide to our air show, the Newbury air show. And again, as far as I can recollect, I mean, we're going back many as a moon here, but it was just this very question. It was a very, purely the first question, our air show. He Francis Pym replied to the fact that, well, you know, good political stuff. He couldn't give those total assurances, but he certainly saw no reason why there shouldn't be a few more air shows until, you know, the operational status of the base changed, and then it would have to be reviewed again. So, in fact, he was right. We had, I think it was 3 more air shows. But that was the very first question. There were one or two questions regarding safety and security, and he answered them from a political aspect. And he gave the assurances that Her Majesty's government was satisfied with all the safety arrangements, that we work very closely with the Americans, that we have a joint planning group that look at this, we're satisfied with safety standards and so on and so forth. But of course it was early days, and the detailed technical implications were probably not apparent to him at that time. But as a meeting, it went very well. And the nice thing was, the meeting finished. Again, there was no significant demonstration. We all went into some buffet provided by the council, and the council members who were there, and all the people who had asked questions were invited through to talk informally to Francis Pym. And it was interesting. It was really quite a fascinating situation. But I would think within a day or so, or maybe the following day, the first of the demonstrators parked themselves at the main gate. And again, I know the women's movement, I know that the sort of, forgive me saying it, the great unwashed element seemed to attract all the highlights in later time. But the first people on the scene were a group of ladies under the leadership of Pat Arrowsmith, who knew Berkshire remarkably well. She was heavily involved in all the Aldermaston marches in the 1960s, and it was quite natural for her to come back. And she camped at the main gate with, I think, some 8 or 9 ladies. I actually made a point of seeing these good ladies, and they were articulate. They registered their protest. They explained why they were there, and they were planning to stay there as long as necessary. And at that point, we sort of agreed to differ. I said, well, I'm very pleased that in this country you are allowed to park yourselves outside of military establishments and protest. That is what freedom is all about, and that's what we're here to defend. So, you know, carry on, type of thing. And they were excellent. Gradually, though, they were... numbers swelled slightly, and I really don't have a date for it. But I do recollect in September of that year, the Battle of Britain church parade, there was a very small demonstration. And I think it was about that time that a contingent from Wales marched into Greenham Common. I know there was a lady, I think the name was Helen Jones, was notionally in charge. But I think it was about this time that they arrived, and they attracted a fair amount of media attention. They actually came with a press vehicle, and they certainly hit the headlines for a while. And gradually they ousted the Pat Arrowsmith contingent. In fact, it was fairly obvious as an outsider, me being the outsider inside the fence looking at these people, that there was a very strange and developing unwelcome relationship between these two groups, to the point whereby I think Pat Arrowsmith and her ladies eventually up sticks and left. And, in fact, before she left, she said, I'm sorry, I have nothing to do with these people here. They are not my type of people. We have a common objective, but their methods and mine differ.
She made that plain, did she?
She made it plain that there was a disagreement. I mean, I would not presume now to use the words directly that were used, but the inference was that, you know, this is a different sort of organisation. But strangely enough, you see, although this protest movement was developing on the outside of the base, life was continuing on the inside. The contracts were being let for development work. And a chap called Richard Noble, who was a marvellous character, he had an organisation called Project Thrust. He was setting out to break all the land speed records. And he arrived with his magic car, Project Thrust, and on the airfield at Greenham Common, took some of the... I think cleared all the UK land speed records and some of the European speed records. Now this was going on, life was going on normally. There were a few people outside. They'd been there for a while. By this stage, the media was by and large transiting past these people at the main gate to come and photograph Richard Noble doing his record-breaking runs on the airfield. I mean, we continued to sort of shoot rabbits around the airfield. They were a pest, incidentally. We had parasending, which was run by the Royal Engineers. They came in and did parasending, which was great fun. But life continued, and for the rest of that period in 1980, from my arrival in May until Christmas, the work was proceeding, and yet there were no significant demonstrations of anything that certainly gels in my mind. We were continually, however, involved with the District Council. Notwithstanding the fact that a military establishment can claim Crown exemption for many things, it has never been the policy of Her Majesty's Government or indeed the Ministry of Defence to establish facilities on bases without going through the planning process. So we lodged plans with the Newbury District Council. Fair dues, they were all appreciated and accepted. I think they'd have been hard placed to change them, to be honest. But they did make certain recommendations based on environmental considerations, and we were very pleased indeed to comply with this. For example, you know, there's one water tower which was required. Well, could we not put it somewhere else because it would be less offensive from the road? Yes, of course we'll do that. These were things, this was within our power to make these variations to accommodate the council. The other organisation we were working with very closely then was one of the nature trusts. I have a feeling BBOT, that stands for the Berkshire, Buckinghamshire, Oxfordshire Naturalist Trust. They were very interested in some land that the military owned on the north side of the airfield. basically the northern boundary of Greenham Common is bounded by what's known as Burry's Bank Road. And north of that road was an old bomb site, or bomb dump, in fact, during the war. And the plans that we started off with were that we were going to put certain missile facilities across there. Nothing nasty, just storage, and indeed at one stage the Americans were thinking of putting some married quarters in there. But personally, and I speak now personally, I felt it would be a terrible desecration. It was beautiful countryside, it was absolutely beautiful land, and we really didn't need to use it. And when the district council suggested that they would prefer that this area was not, in fact, used, working with the Americans and with PSA, we were able to agree that it was unnecessary. And in fact, we eventually handed the land over to the Piedmont to administer it and look after it and all the wildlife and everything that went in there. In fact, during this time, in response to some of the locals who lived in the immediate vicinity, because it was Ministry of Defence land, until we handed over, we often used to have to send Ministry of Defence police in there, not because of CND or any demonstrators, but kids on motorbikes and tearaways trying to use it as dirt tracks and things. We actually used to send the MOD police in there to chase them out, to protect the land, which eventually was handed over to the Wildlife Trust, which was a sort of plus sign. And the other thing that happened, in the area of the site designated for the missiles, the actual, what we call the Gamma site, where the missiles were going to be stored, which was in the western corner of the base, the southwestern corner of the base, one of my own staff was quite an avid naturalist. And in the Ministry of Defence, they, despite what anybody may think, they have a very strong ecological movement. And indeed, they produce their own Ministry of Defence magazine called Sanctuary, which shows the developments and changes to Ministry of Defence land affecting the ecology. And it advertises where they have particular features, special plants, special wildlife, whatever it is, and the actions of the staff to preserve and encourage this type of thing. And my chap called Les Goatley was heavily involved in both birds and, or flora and fauna, if you like, birds and the plants. And in the site where we used to, or where we're planning to build the missiles, was an area where he used to come in with other naturalists to ring wild birds. So again, we were able to make some minor modifications so we didn't remove certain plants and things which were feeding for birds that migrated through the UK. However, there were certain wild orchids there which were in a very vulnerable position. There's nothing we could do about that. So again, the naturalists, using all their skills and resources, carefully, and I wasn't even told where they were moved to, took all these plants and surrounding soil away and relocated them elsewhere so they'd be out of the way of the construction development. These are little things which were going on at Greenham. Nobody knew about it, nobody thought about it, but we were trying to think that we recognised we were in a delightful area. There were features there which were quite unique, and consequently as much as possible was done to avoid, if you like, desecration, for want of a better word. So efforts were made to comply with the local authorities' wishes as well as with the nature involved in wildlife and flora, fauna preservation. This sort of thing was going on all the time. We then had the situation where construction was starting to get underway, and it was necessary to activate what had been an old road across the airfield before the war. It had been closed off during the war, never been reopened since, but this was to provide access for contractors' lorries to come in to the site. And this immediately attracted attention. And we had the beginnings of a reasonably large demonstration. The one thing that I found odd about this demonstration, much of it was being supported by an organisation known as the Newbury Anglo-Soviet Friendship Society. And there was a chap who, if my memory serves me right, was called Milner, was the chairman of the Anglo-Soviet Society, and he was rounding up hippies and all sorts of people, not necessarily favourable towards the Soviets necessarily, but part of this protest meeting was generated under their auspices. And a sort of hippie camp was eventually developed outside the fence on the southwest side of the airfield. While all this was going on, I must admit, we were updating the fence. I mean, I explained in my introduction that the fence was pretty derelict, and well, we replaced the base fence just as you would do in any other military defence establishment. It wasn't a high security fence, it was just a demarcation line with a standard Ministry of Defence fence. But it was attacked occasionally, but nothing desperate. But once we had the contractors in working on the missile storage area, we did have to put up additional security lights. And again, these, the threat of a protest, I rang RAF Abingdon, which was the Royal Air Force unit, which parented us. And, they delivered sodium lights, we wired them in, and that was it. It wasn't too much of a problem. But as we moved into 91, the demonstration activity peaked, and in Easter time in April that year, there was the first of what we would call the large-scale demonstrations that was seen, and the first of the incursions into the base. Now, at this stage, I had a staff of about 20-odd Ministry of Defence policemen, or modplots, as they're often known, and I had to have these people reinforced. Gradually, we brought in some Royal Air Force police as well. But at this stage, it was nothing terribly violent. We had these demonstrations. It was hit the headlines. But from our point of view, it didn't stop any of the activity on the base. As I say, construction was now really sort of getting well underway.
Mm. What sort of form did the demonstrations take at this stage? What were the women doing?
At this stage, it was predominantly tying things on the fence, making a noise, burning torches at night, singing songs, patrolling up and down, and a few incursions. Nothing terribly significant.
And would they all have been women, the demonstrators?
No, far from it. No. There were considerable numbers of women. They were obviously leading the whole thing. But there were very large numbers of fellows. I mean, mums used to come out with their husbands and children, and this was the first time we saw this, but they just came out for the day. There were a very large contingent, and this was the first time it happened, very, very large contingents of hippies, and these were mainly fellows. I mean, the camp outside the Gamma site in the southeast corner was an absolute mess, and in fact, the biggest problem we had there were these hippies, more than the women, frankly. In fact, it reached a stage where, at one point, I had to send Ministry of Defence policemen outside the base to assist the Thames Valley police to make arrests in this hippie camp for drug offences, and we had two charges of grievous bodily harm. You know, these hippies on hippies, or hippies on these peace women, and other visitors. I seem to recollect some outfit called the Elan Valley Mushroom Eaters or something. There are all sorts of funny names. These are people who lived on happy mushrooms, but they were amongst this contingent outside the fence. But it was not exclusively women. The women were seeking to organise it, but it was not on the scale that we saw later. But so these hippies certainly were a nuisance and a pest. But it didn't, as I say, stop any of the ongoing activity. In fact, throughout the summer, we were getting random protests at the weekends. There was an attempt on one occasion, I can't even think of the date, to stop some school buses, which was rather unfortunate. It upset a lot of the kids, and that was a rather unnecessary thing, and that generated a sort of counter-reaction from the locals. And you see, while all this was going on, you had three rival groups, if you like, and I shouldn't use the word rival, but three alternative factions involved. You had the Anglo-American Society. Now, this had been established during the war. Wherever you have Americans in the UK, you create an Anglo-American society. Normally, a worthy local, preferably non-political local, is appointed as the chairman, and you have a committee. Our chairman at this stage was a local farmer by the name of Geoffrey Wallace, I seem to remember. But the Anglo-American committee was made up of local citizens and Americans on the base. I regularly used to chair their meetings. But they were very concerned to show the better face of not only the Americans but the base, and they would organise events on the base and our sister base at Welford. An Anglo-American fair was always a super event. these were attended by the locals, and the demonstrators wouldn't attempt to get involved because they realised that this was not their scene. These were people wishing to be associated with the Americans, and it would be wrong for them to get involved. So they stayed out of it. It was this attempt to upset these kids on the school buses, which was coinciding with planning arrangements for one of these Anglo-American get-togethers, that made them back off. They realised that was a sort of shot in the foot for the demonstrators. But the other group that was involved, we had a base organisation, the name of which escapes me right now. It was a sort of like a community association. Again, I was heavily involved, in fact, I had to chair this group. Now, this did have some political people on it, local elected members, as well as people who lived in the vicinity. And, of course, the Americans were represented there. And this was where we tried to explain how we were going, what we were doing, and what the impact would be, and taking account of grassroots local opinion. Again, this was useful to us. We certainly got opinions, as well as formally through the council. We had this around-the-table discussion. And so you would reach the stage, well, all right. The sort of thing that might come up here, we find the Americans, because they were starting to build up a few in numbers. And we're having a few problems in a particular pub. The local Teddy Boys, or whatever they were, they weren't Teddy Boys by the stage, but you know what I mean. Local toughies were in a particular pub. It'd be better, perhaps, if the Americans didn't go in. Simply because we don't want to provoke it. So they say, okay, right, we can do that. We'll make sure. So to avoid a confrontation, because we were all conscious that the sort of fight. Wherever you've got a garrison town, troops from Thatcham or troops from Hermitage go into a pub and get involved in a punch-up with the locals. It's going to hit the headlines. But it's just, a punch-up between the troops and the locals, normally over girls. But because of the missiles, because of the political connotation, because of the protest movement, every time an American got involved in a punch-up, it was given much more credence than a normal punch-up between a military man and a local. So we were able to make adjustments in that regard. And the third group was a pressure group that was starting, and we never had any direct contact with them, and I can't even remember the name. But basically, they were a loose gathering of locals who were opposed to the demonstrators. And I found this a very difficult situation for the simple reason that I had a remit, a terms of reference, to get the base organized and operational. These people seemed to feel that they were on my side. Well, in some regards, this may be the case, but they were not the side that I really could be either seen to be associated with or would wish to associate with, for the simple reason that I got the impression it was much more politically orientated, and it would have been wholly wrong for me to have been seen to be involved. In fact, I never spoke to them at any stage, and indeed my staff were briefed. If they call, I'm sorry, I cannot and will not speak to them. But they were mounting a fairly vociferous campaign in their own way. But its objectives, I feel, directed against the protesters, was not the sort of thing that it would have been correct for me as the RAF commander to be involved with. So I kept well clear of that. But between these three organisations, you've got minor counter activities which were of note, and one in particular, and again, they organised almost on an ad hoc basis, and it coincided with the demonstration planned to commemorate the first atomic bomb on Hiroshima. Now, this demonstration was held sometime in 81. It must have been, I suspect, early summer. I don't know. I can't remember the date. But basically, it was the first time I'd ever seen them. The demonstrators brought in a gang of Buddhist monks from some monastery at Milton Keynes. They were promptly christened the Ying Tong contingent by all my people. They had these sort of little bells and things like this, and they were singing Ying Tong songs, as we were concerned. But anyway, I was outside the guardroom looking at this demonstration from inside the fence, and there was quite a large contingent there, and all these monks in their saffron robes banging away on their gongs. And I noticed several guys that I'd seen before, and I thought, oh my goodness, many of them are elderly gentlemen, and they were not involved with this demonstration, but they gradually got themselves into a line, and they're all wearing raincoats or trilby hats and overcoats and anoraks and things, and gradually these monks were building up to a crescendo which was supposed to coincide with the dropping of the bomb, and they were going to have 2 minutes silence, and this sort of all these symbols and gongs suddenly stopped, And all these monks bowed their heads. And this line of gentlemen took off their raincoats and overcoats and bowed their heads, and there they stood with their rows of medals. And they were the Burma Star veterans, who, of their own accord, had foregathered at the main gate. And they were also there to commemorate the dropping of the first nuclear or first atomic bomb. And all of a sudden, the cameras that were there, there was television there, there were pressmen, and suddenly they switched from these monks and the girls to this line of elderly gentlemen standing there with their heads bowed. And I was quite touched by all of it. I mean, I recognised, my father's a Burma Star veteran, I recognised they were all Burma Star. And I realised where I'd seen them from Remembrance Day parades in Newbury and this sort of thing. But, you know, unprompted, they had chosen this method of commemorating themselves. And one of them was interviewed afterwards. In fact, they were after this 2 minute silence, the girls in particular were absolutely mad about this, and they were pushing these guys out of the way. And in fact, it was getting very nasty. They were being pushed around and told to go away. It was nothing to do with them. And they would say, it is everything to do with us. You know, if it hadn't happened, we probably wouldn't be here, because, you know, I was in a prisoner of war camp. I might not have survived any longer if the war hadn't finished. Think of all the, you know, so on and so on. Anyway, we got these guys in through the gate, let them onto the base and gave them a cup of tea and sat them down. And this was basically their position, that, you know, if it hadn't been for these weapons, the war would have gone on. Many, many more thousands of soldiers would have not only been killed in action, but would have died in the Japanese prisoner of war camps. And it was a totally counter position to the demonstrators. And it was interesting, though, that particular demonstration, I remember looking in the local paper, and again, if one of your archive people to look through it, you'd probably find the Newbury Weekly News for that time, that the demonstration itself got about 2 column inches, and these gentlemen with their Burma Star medals and all their war campaign medals got half a page, and it was a purely spontaneous local reaction. We got more of these sorts of things happening every time any of the demonstrators attempted to interfere, as they did, in fact. We had a war memorial desecrated in Newbury. Again, all the British Legion on that occasion sort of reinstated it very rapidly and this sort of thing.
What happened to it?
It was daubed with paint. But it was cleaned up in time for the Remembrance Day parade.
And was it the camp women?
Yes, yes it was. Yes it was. That was they were seeing them, and, you know, that was it. But, you know, they weren't prosecuted. But I say, this was happening. We had Secretary of State for Defence by this stage, I think it was a chap called Orr, he came back to visit. That attracted a demonstration. Any time we had a visitor, we got demonstrations. But again, funny enough, Project Thrust, Richard Noble came back to make another couple of runs to clean up some records that he hadn't already taken. And again, media attention was there, focused on him, not on the demonstration outside. The Remembrance Day parade that year, and I said, bearing in mind we had this little thing with the Burma Star, that was the occasion when, in fact, I do notice here the date was the 8th of November was the Remembrance Day parade, when prior to that parade there had been a desecration of the War Memorial in Newbury, and that again, being the local papers, that certainly upset a lot of locals and antagonised the locals. You see, if we can digress here and go back, I've said the Americans have been at Greenham Common since the war. Majority of local people there were quite used to the Americans. We didn't think it anything strange to see Americans moving around. And we didn't think it anything odd that the Americans should join in our Remembrance Day parades. They were always on parade. They were welcome, a feature of the parade. They were part of the community. The majority of local people remembered back to the days when there had been a larger presence there. This was good for trade. All right, you can say the Americans buy a lot of their stuff on their own base stores, but equally a lot of them do spend money downtown.